Okay, Kim, as you know, we do the limerick. Kim is an Oregon resident who, truth be told, I don't think cared for her last president. She's beautiful and classy as can be. She spends a lot of time at sea. Congrats on your year. You're one of a kind and so intelligent. Take as long as you need. Talk about whatever you want. And Kim, thanks to get to know you. You're awesome.
Oh, I love the limerick. As you know, I'm doing this for the limerick. So I'm Kim. I'm in secular recovery, and from that you can draw your conclusions. I was telling Mark and Gra and others when I came into the room that I adore meetings that can't start without me. And then Mark proceeded to let me know that Arlene is speaking after me in this meeting. And it just completely, you know, took me down. I don't know how many pegs, because I don't have any whorehouse stories to tell you out of my story. So I mean, so there you go. You're just stuck with what you get. I'll go all the way back to the beginning this time. I was born to a couple of teenagers. So yeah, they were 19, which wasn't really that uncommon in 1958, which, by the way, I'm turning 63 in a few weeks. So I do always give a disclaimer that I've only been at this gig a year or so. And that means that I don't have any elder type wisdom to impart here. So please understand that you're getting what you pay for. I was born to two teenagers. They were 19. And I think they were pretty ill-equipped for parenthood, as most 19-year-olds probably, even back then, were ill-equipped to be parents. I was followed pretty quickly by two more girls. And so I was the top dog in the pack, and always keenly felt that in so many ways, not least of which was I was always too big for my britches, which in Yank speak means that you're maybe more confident than is warranted. Always been that way. So I was a bossy big sister. I was a know-it-all. I was encouraged by my father to be challenging of authority. I think the fact that he never got a boy, I was supposed to be named Barry, by the way, so I sort of wrecked that plan right out of the gate, but he never got a boy, so he always put all his you can be anything you want to be kind of energy into me, and as a result, I took that on, I think. I was extremely responsible as a child. In fact, the responsibility that was put on my shoulders was too much for me sometimes. I had a good childhood. I can't say that much bad about it. My father definitely was an alcoholic. He was a come home and drink every night. And he, as most of us do, or at least in my family, that's the way it works. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse in terms of functioning. But he was not. He was a pretty happy drunk. He was irritable, grouchy, grumpy when he didn't have a drink at hand. So I grew up feeling pretty good about myself, actually, feeling maybe, as I said, more confident than was warranted. I never used drink in order to be social or have fun or have more confidence. I started when I was about 14. It was a tiny town in the middle of the United States. And so everybody knew everything there was to know about everybody. My parents had a police scanner, so we had to be super careful about, you know, having any encounters with the police. But probably I wasn't as careful as I could have been, because I did start drinking at about 14, and we would sneak into bars. We mostly, though, would take our alcohol and climb over barbed wire fences and do our drinking in the cornfields with our friends. You know, everybody would say, oh, I'm staying overnight with so-and-so tonight. I'm staying overnight with so-and-so. And then we'd all gather in the cornfield and drink. So it was fun. I mean, I don't think that I drank any more than everybody else did in the teen years. It was pretty boring to live there. So you know, we drank. Other drugs were available, but I was afraid of them. I had a boyfriend from age 16 who was my first love, my first lover. I adored him. But he, his brother got him into some heavier stuff, and psychedelics were among them. So he would call me in the middle of the night and talk to me late into the night while he was tripping. And that just scared the shit out of me. I had no interest in that stuff. When we were both 18, 19, kind of on the cusp there of 19, we had already broken up. I had moved to the state of Texas to start to embark on my adult life. He hung himself and left me the note. And I, to this day, don't know what the note said to me, because his family confiscated it and never shared it with me. But anyway, the whole drug thing just really never was, he scared me off of it. So for that, I'm eternally grateful. So I got on with my life at age 18. I was washing dishes with my mom, and I was drying the dishes she was washing. And I said, "Mom, I'm going to move to Texas," with my then boyfriend, who was 14 years older than I was, to my parents' horror. But, you know, they were pretty great about, you know, "Okay, fly bird, fly out of the nest, go for it." So I did. I moved to Texas with this boyfriend, which turned out to be a pretty heavy drinking experience, it didn't end well. We parted ways pretty quickly after I moved to Texas. And then I started college. College, I would say that I probably drank, in terms of my drinking years, I probably drank the least in college, because I was busy. I had to go to college. I had to work two jobs. I had to get through college somehow and pay for it. So that was probably my lowest level of drinking while I was drinking. On into law school, where I don't think that I was drinking too awfully much. In fact, I had a roommate, and I felt so much pity for her, because she would buy these jugs of wine, which were off limits to the rest of the household, of course, and she would power them down. So she'd be wandering around, kind of, you know, really in the bag most nights, and she would drink and dial. And I remember feeling such pity for her, her isolated, you know, kind of sneaky drinking. Oh, little did I know that I was seeing my own future there in that picture. But anyway, I felt sorry for her. So then I embarked on career. Career was in the law, and simultaneously I got into the boating, not voting, boating, BOATING world, both of which are heavy drinking worlds. I drank probably within what would be considered normal parameters, which was a lot. I mean, oceans and rivers of alcohol. In my career life, I was working really hard and noticing that the alcohol would come out at, you know, just about 5 o'clock. When I was early days, I couldn't do that because I had too much work I had to get done. So I couldn't do that. But, you know, the weekends and the firm parties and the docks. I mean, today is a good example. Today is sail race day. And boy, is there going to be some heavy duty partying on the docks here as soon as they all come back. So a lot of drinking. But again, I think I was within normal parameters. All through those years, until I wasn't. There came a period in about 2000 when I was drinking to blackout stage. The hangovers were just so painful. They were killing me. Probably not killing me then. I was young and more, my body was more resilient than it is now. So probably not literally killing me, but I felt awful a lot of the time. I was noticing that there were really embarrassing things that other people were doing, like sleeping with secretaries in the process of firm parties, and they were injuring other people. So my husband and I quit drinking, and we did that for, I think it was about 6 years. And I'm not clear on that because there wasn't any kind of treatment program. There wasn't any kind of, you know, AA or smart recovery or anything really, just a, this is really, really bad for us, what we're doing. So we stopped. Here's where I have to say that I truly don't understand the term dry drunk. I really don't understand that term because those were good years. I mean, the absence of alcohol in my life was really a good thing. I think that it allowed me to get even further along in my career. I was, you know, as happy as people can be or as a person could be, I think. So I really truly don't understand the terminology dry drunk. It was good. But I also had in the back of my mind this picture because, you know, drinking had been fun. It had been normal. It had been good, except for some of the icky parts. I had in the back of my mind all that time, this picture of myself becoming this old lady and drinking as much as I wanted to drink once I got old enough to, you know, for it not to really matter, not for it not to matter if I, you know, had a hangover or I would be unlikely to be out where I'd be doing anything embarrassing. I had that in the back of my mind that it wasn't forever. And that was probably... Yeah, no, I know it's a one day at a time thing, but I do think that kind of it's not forever was there when I had to travel to the East Coast from the West Coast to get some training. And I got to an airport and I saw my most favorite bottle sitting in the bar. You know, they have glass there so you can see the whole array. And I thought, oh, wouldn't this flight be so much more relaxing? And that I took that first drink, the fatal drink, and that launched me. It absolutely launched me. And it's astonishing to me, although perhaps not to others, how quickly after years, I went right back as far as quantity and physical consequence to where I was before. Of course, at that point, the physical consequences weren't nearly what they would become, but it was astonishing to me how quickly I started, you know, drinking to blackout point again, having hangovers. But here is the difference. At that point, so many people thought that I was a non-drinker that I wanted it to stay that way. So I became a liar and a sneak I'd go to different liquor stores. Yeah, everybody knows this one. So the clerk didn't think that I was an alcoholic. I thought I was okay to drive when I wasn't okay to drive. I probably wasn't fooling as many people as I thought I was for the entire period. And certainly I was fooling almost no one by the last days of my drinking, but I was a sneaky drinker. So I don't have until the very end too many consequences where, you know, I did things in public or I was out and about, or I found myself, in situations outside of my home because my drinking took place in my room. I had my box of wine and I would go to town on that, usually starting on the weekends. I got along that way and actually thinking I was fooling my husband for the longest time until he started making comments that made me realize that he knew darn well that I was drunk when I was, you know, pretending to be sober. And so he knew for a lot longer than I knew he knew that I had returned to drinking, but that went on years. I was still, you know, getting up and doing my job and going to work and meeting my responsibilities, getting paid, all of that, years. But there came a point when, yeah, that was no longer the case. And just this morning, I went to a meeting where the topic was the impact or drinking and work. That was the topic, drinking and work. And it gutted me. I couldn't even say anything. And I'm not even ready to talk about it to all of you to the extent that I will do someday when I have more distance from it. I don't feel that this is an act of dishonesty on my part. My husband knows everything. Certainly, there are people I worked with who know everything, but it is so shameful and so painful to me that I'm just not ready to, you know, spill it all at this point. But suffice it to say that I got to the point where I needed to drink in order to feel like I was going to live another day. I was so physically addicted to alcohol that I had to, at least on weekends, if not other days where I would have to call in sick, start drinking in the morning. And the blackouts became more frightening. You know, I related to you that I felt relatively safe as a drinker, secret drinker in my own room. But one time I found myself in an airport waiting room with my work computer. I had taken an Uber to take a flight that wasn't scheduled to leave until the next day. And I only have the vaguest memories of some man sitting next to me and me telling him how very kind he was. Somehow I kept my wallet, my work computer, my physical safety and all of that intact. But that scared the shit out of me. And it still wasn't enough. I mean, it still wasn't enough to make me say, well, it was enough to make me say, oh, I have to, you know, I have to do something about this. And many times I had tried to do something about it. I had tried to make rules, the rules phase, which had been quite a long time before. Only on weekends, blah, blah, blah. All the rules were broken, but that wasn't even enough to scare me into actually doing something about it, to actually seeking help. In fact, at probably about that point, my husband asked me, what can I do? What is it that I can do? And I said to him, let me drink. I want to drink. And I want to drink. So let me drink. I can deal with this. I'm still going to work. I'm still, you know, pulling down the paycheck. I'm still meeting my responsibilities. I had met a lot of responsibilities in addition to my work. My husband and I never had children. So we took care of the old people in our family. And we did a really, really good job at that. We also were the world's greatest aunt and uncle. So I, in my own mind, was thinking, you know, as long as I keep it confined to my bedroom, what difference does it make? How is it going to hurt anything? And I had by that time a pretty high tolerance for shame and embarrassment and regret. You know, I mean, just take that airport thing, for example. In my mind, it was like, ugh, well, that was a one and done, right? I won't do anything like that again. And then things just got worse and worse. My physical addiction became worse. Like I said, I'm not ready to talk about everything in detail. It guts me. It really does. I jeopardized my retirement, which was about this time last year. And it was about this time last year, because of that finally just smacked me in the face, because I had really been hanging in with, you know, working and all of that in order to retire and to retire correctly. And it actually cost me a lot in terms of my mental health, because that's just a whole other story with regard to my actual job. So I decided that I did need help. I did not want to drink anymore. And obviously I needed to take some sort of definitive action. So my husband and I went to my doctor, and I confessed everything to my doctor, and she was mad at me because all these years, you know, I had never told her what was going on with me. And she was kind of angry with me that I had never revealed that to her, the quantities of alcohol that I had consumed over our many years doctor-patient relationship. So she referred me somewhat coldly to treatment. And I, you know, went into the first one that she referred me to. And that one was a straight up 12 and 12 program. And most of you have heard this story before. That was horrifying to me. I almost left, but I so needed to stop drinking. I mean, that was really the most important thing in my life, because I was going to die if I didn't stop. And so I stayed with it. And then, as most of you have also heard, a global pandemic intervened to save my life. Everything went online, and I found secular AA. So I found my people. I have had a very good process of recovery. And although my program doesn't look like anybody else's program, just as your program wouldn't look like anybody else's program, et cetera, et cetera, I've probably been as happy as I have ever been in this last year. My program is a crazy quilt of various philosophies and disciplines. It's a crazy quilt, but it's working for me. And one of the most important parts of my crazy quilt program is these meetings where I have made connections, and where I can listen to the stories of others. Not so much to look for. I had an epiphany one day, thanks to something somebody in this room said one day about listening to other stories. I am neither looking for neither similarities nor differences. I'm just listening to the story because I want to know that person, because most of you I see in the rooms over and over and over again. And the more I hear your stories, the more connected I feel to you. And the more connected I feel to you, the more I feel that my program is going to be successful, because I'm heard. You take me as I am, no matter how I am. And I get to hear you. I get to learn so much from the shares of other people in these rooms. So this is maybe the biggest part of my recovery. With your help, I like the responsibility pledge, and I apply it to myself, because for me, every day, the minimum daily requirement is not drinking. Don't drink. I'm only powerless over alcohol if I pick up that first drink, like that drink in the airport that day. And if I do that, that's all she wrote. Probably I would die this time, unless I could find my way back. Probably I would die. So I am responsible for not taking that first drink. And the secular AA rooms have been I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's been the biggest part of my recovery. It's been certainly one of the most joyful parts, because I've really, I get to come here and be with all of you. I get to not drink today. It makes me happy. And, drinking first it was good, I have to say, pretty much unmitigated good. And then it was good with bad. And then it was just bad. And I get to not drink. I get to come here and be with all of you. And I get to listen to your stories. And so with that, I'm going to shut up, because I want to hear some more of those stories. And that's all I got for you. So from my heart to yours.